Been a professor of philosophy, it sounds something like close to 50 years at University of Rochester in New York. Obviously, one of the aspects of nonviolence that you've had to take a look at has been the just war theory. And there's a number of theories, counter, pro and counter, over the centuries. Could you lay out for people what you can say about just war theory, in favor of it, counter of it, and how wars in general have measured up against that kind of standard?
Yes, the just war theory has two different dimensions to it. There is one aspect of the just war theory. It's often referred to as jus ad bellum, but that simply means justice in the recourse to war. The just war theory sets forth a number of conditions, all of which have to be met before a nation or a state is justified in going to war. The list that you get varies somewhat with different just war theorists, but basically, first condition is that you have to have legitimate authority. Not just anyone or any group of people can wage war, but there has to be an established authority within a society or a state. Secondly, and in some ways perhaps the most important condition, there has to be a just cause. What constitutes a just cause varies considerably in the accounts of different just war theorists. St. Augustine, back in the 5th century, who is frequently considered the father of the just war theory, said that a just cause involves the avenging of the violation of a right. So if a state had a right violated or its rights violated, then it had a just cause for going to war. At the present time, many just war theorists either say that self-defense is the only just cause for going to war, or there is a much more complex set of conditions, which include protecting innocent human life, preserving the conditions of a decent human existence, defending human rights of various sorts. And the American Catholic bishops have actually set out a much more elaborate conception of a just cause, which includes those notions. Now, interestingly, before I say more about the conditions of the just war theory, that particular approach opens the door to using force to intervene in other countries on human rights issues. And that's one of the grounds in which so-called humanitarian intervention has developed and been discussed at great length in the last 10 years. In addition to legitimate authority and a just cause, virtually all just war theorists require that there be a right intention, as they call it. St. Thomas Aquinas added this condition to the conditions that Augustine had discussed, and he said that you have to have the right intention, which means an intention to bring about a good rather than evil. And we can see simple examples of this just in everyday life. If I go to the movies, my intention is to be entertained for a couple of hours. That's what I intend, and that's good. But I can foresee that going to the movies will separate me from $15 or $20, depending upon how much popcorn I eat and so on. And that's bad, but that's not my intention. And by the same token, I can foresee that if I drive to the grocery store to get a loaf of bread, my intention is to get the bread, and that is good. But I can foresee that I'm going to burn a certain amount of gasoline, and that, all things being equal, it's bad. So that's foreseeable, but that's not part of what I intend. So if we take this distinction, which seems to make perfectly good sense in a lot of just ordinary contexts, and we apply it to the case of war, we can see how just war theorists begin to mount the justification for war, which they want to provide, because they claim that when you go to war, you can foresee that you're going to cause a lot of death and destruction and harm and so forth. But so long as you are intending only the good, and as long as various other conditions are met as well, then you're justified in doing that. In addition to right intention, just war theorists want to emphasize that there has to be some probability of success. No point in going to war with all of the costs of it and so on if there's no chance that you're going to bring about what you want to achieve. Furthermore, and this is one of the most important of the conditions in this dimension of the just war theory, that is, what justifies the recourse to war, just war theorists, at least until recently, have said that war must be a last resort, that you must pursue all of the avenues for a peaceful resolution of whatever issues divide you and your adversary before you resort to war. Recently, some just war theorists have pretty much wanted to scuttle that particular condition, because if you look back at some of the recent wars that the U.S. has been involved in, I'm referring now to the Gulf War in 1991, and then the later war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, which are still ongoing. In each of those cases, it's pretty clear that war was not a last resort. If you review the evolution of the U.S. attack upon Iraq after Iraq invaded Kuwait, at no point was there any attempt for a negotiated settlement. Then President Bush, that is the father of our recent president, that made it clear that he wouldn't negotiate with Saddam Hussein and issued an ultimatum that Hussein had to withdraw Iraqi troops from Kuwait, and which eventually they did. But war wasn't the last resort. It was almost the first thing that then President Bush began preparing for after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. And very much the same thing was true with the attack on Afghanistan after the 9/11 terror attack. In less than a month after the attack, the U.S. waged war on Afghanistan, even though there were no Afghans involved in the 9/11 attack. 15 of the hijackers of those planes were Saudi Arabians, and none of them were Afghans, and none of them were Taliban. So the Taliban was not directly involved in any way in that attack. The Taliban, of course, were largely in control of Afghanistan, but not entirely so. There had been an ongoing civil war. The so-called Northern Alliance in the northern part of Afghanistan was still holding out against the Taliban, and we sided with them. But the point is that in less than a month after 9/11, we waged war on another country that had no demonstrable connection with 9/11 other than the fact that Osama bin Laden had been training in Afghanistan. The Taliban, we demanded that they turn over Osama bin Laden, and they said that they could do so if we produced evidence that he was responsible for the 9/11 attack. We didn't do that, and there's still is not conclusive evidence that he was responsible for it. He denied it at the time, even though he approved of the attack. And partly also, I think, a cultural matter came into play here, because among Muslims, there's the idea that if someone is a guest in your home or perhaps in your country, you have to treat them with respect, and you don't just turn them over to their enemy, which they would have done if they turned over Osama bin Laden, assuming that they could have found him and that they could have turned him over if they'd wanted to, which is open to question. By the same token, the attack on Iraq, that wasn't a last resort. We had maintained that they had weapons of mass destruction. We sent inspectors in. They couldn't find anything. We could have sent more inspectors. We could have sent in 200,000 inspectors rather than 200,000 troops if we had chosen to, but we chose war. In any event, coming back to my point about the condition of last resort, many just war theorists think that these three wars are just wars, but since they fail to meet the condition of last resort, they want to drop the condition of last resort as one of the criteria for going to war. I should add one further qualification there. There's a condition of proportionality, which most just war theorists feel has to be met before one is justified in going to war. That's just basically that the good that one expects to achieve by the war must outweigh the bad and cost in lives and suffering. The other dimension of the just war theory has to do with the conduct of war. Once you've gone to war, then the just war theory says you should conduct the war according to certain standards, whether you were justified in going to war in the first place or not. Here, once again, proportionality comes into play, because individual actions in war must be expected to bring about a greater good than bad. But the important distinction here is what is often referred to as discrimination. And that is, one must distinguish between those persons whom one may justifiably kill in wartime and those whom one may not justifiably kill. And there are two different ways of drawing that distinction, and both pro-war and anti-war people tend to favor the one that's best supports their particular position. The simplest way of drawing the distinction is to say that it's okay to kill soldiers in wartime, but it's not okay to kill civilians. This has some historical precedence, and it's a fairly simple criterion because soldiers are expected to wear uniforms. And in fact, that's one of the reasons historically why soldiers wear uniforms, is so that they can be easily identifiable as fair game to kill. The other distinction, however, is between the innocent and the non-innocent. Many people argue, and I would myself, that one may not justifiably kill innocent people in wartime. I would also argue that one can't justifiably kill non-innocent people either, but that's a more controversial issue. And the reason why this is a much more difficult distinction to operate with from the standpoint of discrimination is that it's not easy to tell who's innocent and who's non-innocent. And one might argue fairly plausibly that a lot of soldiers are actually innocent, at least with regard to the issues that led to a war, because very often they had no part in undertaking the actions or setting the policies which have led to war. And very often it's the case they don't even know what a lot of those issues are. Sometimes when soldiers are sent off to other parts of the world, they couldn't even locate the countries on a map if they were asked to do so. So arguably, many soldiers are innocent. And at the same time, if a war is an unjust war, might very well be that many people who are actually civilians are non-innocent because, say, in a country like ours, the president is a civilian. He's not a military officer, even though he's commander-in-chief of the forces. And by the same token, cabinet officers and others, and similarly with cabinets in parliamentary governments, very often are civilians. So they might not be innocent. So the distinction between innocent and non-innocent is a very difficult one. And when you are dealing with wars that are of the sort we see going on in Afghanistan and now to a lesser degree, but still significantly in Iraq, this becomes an important issue because these are basically guerrilla warfare that's going on there. These are people who are in their homeland, and a power, a mighty power, military power like the United States, is prepared and has the weaponry for much higher levels of violence than are represented by these particular conflicts. And it makes it difficult for them to use their weapons to our advantage without causing a great number of casualties to civilians. And that's what we're seeing in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And that's the source, I think, of much of the justifiable criticism of those two wars.
There is